Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida hospitals could face major state funding cuts, and advocates worry the poor and disabled will be the really big losers.
It's a big story to see a state contemplate these kinds of really draconian cuts.
Also tonight, a major Florida university looking at litigation stemming from an on-campus shooting incident more than 2 years ago.
You know, it's a situation that none of us would trade positions for that for all the money in the world. And so he's seeking the financial compensation that can really just allow him to try to survive.
We'll also catch up on the latest legislative action when it comes to crimes against healthcare providers, pesticide protection for farm workers, and state government's never-ending quest to save money on computing systems. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's day two of the fourth week of the Florida legislative session, and you're in tune with Capitol Report. The Florida House and Senate are planning big cuts to Florida hospitals, and those groups say it will hurt medical care access for the poor and disabled. We get the latest on that story from Sarah Mueller.
Edgewater resident Adrienne Gorham works as a sign language interpreter. She says she makes too much money from Medicaid. That's one reason she's deep in debt on medical bills she can't pay after a car accident 2 years ago. Many Florida hospitals serve people who are uninsured or on Medicaid. They get reimbursed in a variety of ways, including a base rate reimbursement, Medicaid enhancement payments, and help absorbing uncompensated care. The state and federal government pay a certain rate for services for people on Medicaid, but it's less than the actual cost of services. And Bruce Rubin of the Florida Hospital Association says that reimbursement rate could be much lower next year under the proposed House budget.
It's a big story to see a state contemplate these kinds of really draconian cuts in the House budget.
The Florida House is proposing cutting the base Medicaid rate by 7%, which means Florida hospitals will get paid less for patients on Medicaid. They'll also get less federal matching funds, so hospitals may see a $622 million loss next year. Rubin says that could force hospitals to offer fewer services or pass more of the cost onto people with private insurance. The Senate isn't proposing a rate reduction, but it is considering cutting Medicaid supplemental payments by $99 million, or a $258 million loss with the federal match. The House also wants to trim $477 million in supplemental payments to hospitals. House Appropriations Chair Jason Broder says he wants to, quote, glide down the payments hospitals get beyond the rates.
Nobody's a payment rate could go above 5% or below 5% of what they got so that it smooths it out over time. What we don't want to have happen is implement a policy and then have either the bottom fall out or somebody get an enormous amount of money for no difference in effort.
But Appropriation Chairwoman Anna Terry Flores says hospitals still end up ahead.
We could really see it as it's an increase. So that's the way that the math works. Ready? I'm going to blow your mind here. Are you ready?
Hospitals will come out ahead in the Senate budget, says Flores, because it still counts low-income pool money, also known as LIP. LIP is made up of local government and federal matching dollars to cover the expenses of hospitals who care for the uninsured. President Barack Obama's administration eliminated the LIP pool because it wanted Florida to expand Medicaid to cover the uninsured charity care. Flores says they've been talking to President Donald Trump's administration about returning about $600 million to the state for this budget year. The House's budget doesn't include LIP funding. Bruce Rubin of the Florida Hospital Association says some hospitals will be hurt if the legislature cuts Medicaid funding. But he says he worries more about cuts to medical access to the poor and disabled, especially in a state that has more money than it spends.
There's no critical need to make these kinds of cuts. This is just something that they've decided to do.
Rubin says more people on private pay will pick up the cost of the budget cuts. He says it amounts to a hidden tax. Florida's Health and Human Services budget makes up about a third of the state's $82 billion budget. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
Florida State University could soon face a lawsuit following a shooting on campus that left one student paralyzed. Ronnie Ahmed was shot multiple times by the man who opened fire in Strozier Library on a late night in November of 2014. Lynn Hatter reports that issue is whether the school was negligent in its security.
Ahmed was left paralyzed from the waist down and lost the use of one of his arms. Daily tasks like showering and going to the bathroom are a struggle. The family needs a full-time caregiver, but so far has only been able to find part-time help. And the cost of medical care for the rest of Ahmed's life is staggering, says his attorney, Eric Abrahamson.
It's a situation that none of us would trade positions for that for all the money in the world. And so he's seeking the financial compensation that can really just allow him to try to survive both with future medical and future caretakers and be like the rest of us as much as he can.
Campus police responded quickly to the November 2014 shooting at Strozier Library, but the shooter, a former FSU student suffering from mental illness, was in the area for about 25 minutes before he opened fire. He'd previously tried to enter the library but was blocked at the turnstiles, and Abrahamson wonders why the student assigned to act as security at the facility failed to report the incident.
The suit is relation to negligent security, that we say that Florida State provided negligent security and that Myron May, the shooter at Florida State, could have been stopped before he opened fire, injuring Ronnie Ahmed. And so our suit is seeking damages that Mr. Ahmed has, obviously significant damages in relation to that negligent security that FSU provided. And we're hoping that that we can resolve that litigation with Florida State.
In a statement, Florida State University says it, quote, has shown great care and concern for Ronnie and has provided support for him and his family. We are disappointed anyone would question FSU's response to the shooting. According to the gun safety advocacy group Everytown, there have been nearly 100 shootings on college and university campuses since 2013, when the group began tracking. FSU became one of 30 schools in 2014 to report a shooting incident on campus. Lawsuits following school shootings have become routine. Two parents of students killed in the Newtown, Connecticut school shooting settled a negligence claim against the school district last year. Parents of two students killed in the Virginia Tech shooting of 2007 sued the school, but a ruling in their favor was overturned on appeal in 2013. Abrahamson says he'd like to reach some sort of settlement with Florida State. He says he's been in contact with the university both before filing the notice of intent to sue and after. Any sort of settlement or judgment in excess of $200,000 a person or $300,000 per claim would have to be approved by the Florida legislature, a process that could take years or decades. It's something Abrahamson says the family is prepared to deal with.
In anticipation of that, multiple people have been working on his behalf, both lobbyists and legislators that are interested in pursuing a claims bill on his behalf should we get a judgment in excess of $200,000.
While the lawsuit focuses on negligence, Abrahamson says the issue is about quality of life. Ahmed's condition will require a lifetime of care, a situation that could cost millions. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
A controversial proposal for the state to oversee aspects of high-speed rail intended to slow a planned private passenger rail service linking Orlando and Miami might have been derailed in the House. The Transportation and Infrastructure Subcommittee today declined to hear the proposal, which in part sought to give the Florida Department of Transportation oversight of issues not preempted by federal law. The bill came as part of a long-running controversy about All Aboard Florida's Brightline rail service, which is planned to carry passengers between Miami and Orlando. Residents and local governments in the state's Treasure Coast region have fought the plans. The subcommittee, the first of three House panels that could hear the proposal, is not scheduled to meet again during the legislative session. However, sponsors insist they're not giving up. Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida lawmakers are considering stiffer penalties for those who commit crimes against the state's health care providers.
Serious workplace violence happens to health care workers four times more than in any other industry. Those are pretty interesting statistics.
Florida lawmakers are looking at doing away with fees charged to pesticide manufacturers, but one advocate worries the change could lead to more harmful exposure for farm workers.
It's going to be worse for the workers. I mean, they continually put in pesticides on the market, and more tests have to be done.
House members approving a handful of changes to the state's alcohol regulatory system, and the moves could prove lucrative for the industry.
There are all sorts of events, all sorts of venues, and all sorts of opportunities for everyone to participate at a level that they can afford, and we would be glad to take all of their money.
And while some lawmakers are pushing for a new technology plan, others argue the current system just needs some routine maintenance.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org.
A bill increasing the penalties against someone who assaults Florida doctors, nurses, and other health care providers passed its first House panel today. We get that story from Sasha Cordner.
Jean Gail Boyd now represents the Florida Nurses Association, but when she was younger, she says she survived an assault while working in a hospital.
I have to say, I would not have had my third child. I would not have had any of my grandchildren if I had survived an assault that was leveled against me. I was working on the cardiac unit of one of our local hospitals when I had a family member not only stalk me, but later try to kill me. And fortunately for me, I'm still here. Fortunately for my family.
And Boyd says she's just one of a growing number of statistics.
One, serious workplace violence happens to healthcare workers four times more than in any other industry. Second, 80% of serious violence incidents reported in the healthcare settings are caused by interactions with patients, but it also happens with families and visitors.
And Alyssa LaPolt, also with the Florida Nurses Association, says addressing these acts are a big priority for nurses.
And representing the Florida Nurses Association now for almost 6 years, this issue is top of the list. It is one of the issues that leads to retention problems. We know we have a workforce shortage of nurses in this state. Assault and battery of nurses and healthcare providers is a real thing. It is not often talked about.
So Coral Gables Democratic Representative Daisy Baez wants to help address this issue for all healthcare workers with a bill she filed to increase penalties.
Our current law provides that when a person is charged with committing an assault or battery on a law enforcement officer, firefighter, or other specified persons while they're engaged in the lawful performance of their duties, that the offense is to be reclassified to the next highest degree. The bill adds healthcare providers to the list of persons which triggers reclassification for assault and battery. The bill defines healthcare providers to include physicians, registered nurses, and hospital volunteers.
And her bill received unanimous approval in the House Criminal Justice Subcommittee Tuesday. It has two more stops before it heads to the House floor. Meanwhile, its Senate companion has not yet had a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
State lawmakers want to cut fees for the manufacturers of harmful pesticides that could make it cheaper for chemical companies to sell their products in the state. Kate Payne reports one advocate is worried how the change could affect farm workers' health.
Tirso Moreno leads the Farmworker Association of Florida, and he spends a lot of his time on pesticide education. He says pesticide exposure is making workers sick.
Chronic respiratory problems. We have a lot of people with cancer. Those are two problems. We have a lot of people with skin problems, with chronic headaches, you name it.
Back in the 1960s, Florida began screening produce for dangerous levels of pesticides. The federal government keeps tabs on potentially harmful chemicals that should only be consumed in certain amounts. And the state's Chemical Residue Laboratory makes sure Florida produce stays below those levels. Currently, manufacturers of those pesticides help pay for the testing through supplemental fees. But Jonesville Republican Representative Chuck Clemens wants to change that.
The proposed committee bill today eliminates the supplemental fee.
In a committee meeting Tuesday, Coconut Creek Democratic Representative Kristen Jacobs asked how cutting into the lab's funding could affect its operations.
What is the offset to that? Where are these funds coming from, particularly in a tight budget year? What I want to know is where are these dollars going to come from now as a result of it being funded through the state without the user fee?
But Clemens says the state used to pick up the tab until the Great Recession. In 2009, pesticide manufacturers agreed to pay the testing costs through supplemental fees on top of regular registration costs.
Now that the state is no longer in the state of extingency, the industry is wanting to put this back to the state.
House lawmakers say the economy has recovered, freeing up the state to fund the lab entirely. And they say the change won't affect operations. Auburndale Republican Representative Neil Cumbie says eliminating the fee could encourage more manufacturers to bring their business to Florida.
So it keeps some people from having access to certain products that may be beneficial, but they're not available because we're just not going to register and pay the fee. So this will eliminate that problem as well.
That worries Tirso Moreno. He says cutting the cost to manufacturers could open the door for more potentially harmful pesticides and more exposure for farm workers.
It's going to be worse for the workers. I mean, they continually put in pesticides on the market, and more tests have to be done, as I say before. The situation is going to be worse for us.
The House is fast-tracking the measure. After a single committee hearing, the bill is ready for a floor vote. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
The House Careers and Competition Committee took up and passed a handful of alcohol measures today. Nick Evans has more.
After spending 3 years wrestling over whether to legalize the 64-ounce growler, state lawmakers appear much more comfortable amending Florida's alcohol regulations. The state operates under a model established at the end of Prohibition, splitting production, distribution, and retail into distinct spheres of business. That separation is meant to halt the so-called tied house evil, where one entity exerts control in the marketplace by tying a retailer to a producer. But those distinctions are growing fuzzier with each additional piece of legislation, and maintaining the separation means diving into the minutia.
If there's a possibility to bring it down to two cases of two brands instead of three, I would much rather see that when this bill comes up the next stop. So
that's Lantana Democratic Representative Al Jaquette, raising concerns about a measure allowing distributors to give up to three cases of branded glassware to bars and restaurants. Under current law, glasses are treated as inducements, giving producers or distributors too much influence over retailers. Still, Jaquette voted for the bill, and it passed easily. Another bill allows theme parks and brewers to engage in cooperative advertising agreements. Florida Brewers Guild lobbyist Josh Abishan worries those agreements will freeze out craft brewers.
The law has been in place for a long time just to prevent those sort of tide house evils. And I know it always sounds funny to say tide house evil, like it's malicious and whatnot. But it really is to prevent, someone from coming in and pricing everyone else out of the market. I mean, you look at soft drinks. A lot of times when you go to one, they only have Coke or Pepsi. They don't have both.
But Max Stepanovich, speaking on behalf of Universal Studios, contends there's room for partnerships with large producers and small ones.
There are events, whether they're concerts or whatever, of all different sizes. There are venues. Everything's not a Harry Potter ride. There are all sorts of events, all sorts of venues, and all sorts of opportunities for everyone to participate at a level that they can afford, and we would be glad to take all of their money.
That proposal passed too. The panel also took up St. John's Republican Representative Cindy Stevenson's craft distilling changes. Florida law defines craft distillers as those producing 75,000 or fewer gallons a year, and it limits sales at the distillery to 2 bottles per branded product, whiskey, gin, and so on. Stevenson wants to raise the limit to 6 bottles.
Primarily, these sales are to tourists to spread the word on Florida's quality craft spirits to their friends and retailers at home. Increasing this bottle limit helps these small distilleries meet customer demand, encourages the industry to grow, and benefits the small Florida family farms that provide our citrus, corn, and sugarcane.
Stevenson's measure, like the other two, gained approval. Lawmakers remain wary of loosening their grip on the state's alcohol production system. But for now, it seems, the GOP-led legislature's inclination toward lighter regulation carries more weight. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
A proposal to halt local regulation of vacation rentals passed in committee today after heated debate. Joseph Zabias Roig reports that a battle is brewing over property and community rights.
In 2011, the Florida legislature barred cities from regulating short-term vacation rentals and preempted local control. 3 years later, the legislature returned some authority to city governments, allowing them to enact new ordinances such as building requirements. But Representative Mike LaRosa, the bill's sponsor, says many ordinances passed to address vacation rentals are infringing on property rights.
Since that time, we've seen an obscene amount of ordinances, to the point to where individuals' private property rights have been violated. This has come in cities across our state.
The House bill moved forward in a 9-6 vote. It would nullify any ordinances passed since 2011 related to short-term rentals, and once again bar cities from regulating vacation rentals of private homes. Any ordinances in effect before June 1, 2011 would remain on the books. Business groups like the Florida Chamber of Commerce and the Florida Association of Realtors are backing the bill. But the proposal has its critics. Ruth Eaker, a resident of Anna Maria, urged lawmakers to vote no. She says communities must be able to solve any problems stemming from the home sharing industry on their own.
We do not want to overly regulate usage nor interfere with property rights, but we do want to retain the tools we have to solve local problems. And one of those major tools is our ordinance, which is a very good ordinance that works well.
Her concerns were echoed by Assistant Miami City Attorney Carrie McNulty. She says cities like Miami must retain the power to address the concerns of residents who complain about short-term rentals operating in residential neighborhoods.
We are being inundated with calls from our residential neighborhoods who are complaining about these short-term rentals, which are essentially businesses being operated in our residential and mixed-use neighborhoods. We have not passed any specific regulations in response to these short-term rentals, but we would like to in order to regulate them.
In Florida, the home-sharing industry is booming. Companies like Airbnb have surged in popularity, connecting homeowners with travelers who want to save money. The bill has one more stop before it reaches the House floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Joseph Zabalos Roy.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, Florida House lawmakers are moving forward with a plan to revamp the state's information technology system, as we hear from Regan McCarthy.
Representative Blaise Angolia, who chairs the Government Operations and Technology Appropriations Subcommittee, says over the years, the cost of Florida's information technology system has started to skyrocket.
It's pretty shocking. If you consider the cost of our state data center from the time our agencies were consolidated in the data center through AST's fiscal year 2017-2018 budget recommendations by the governor, our state data center costs have risen 32%.
And Golia says that growth rate outpaces the percent cost increase of Medicaid, one of the fastest growing costs in the state. He's proposing a bill that would reorganize the state's IT structure. One part of that plan includes a policy Angolia says emphasizes cloud computing.
Because we have always spoken about operating in the cloud, but we have never yet adopted a policy that put cloud first. We are going to do that today, as some other states have.
The measure also creates an Office of Technology and Data Solutions and requires the governor to appoint a state chief information officer. The plan also abolishes the Florida Agency for State Technology and places the Office of Technology and Data Solutions under the Department of Management Services. And Golia says the idea is to ensure data is available while allowing the state's technology workers to focus on their jobs.
And we believe that by doing that and freeing up the tech geeks do what they do, and really focus on IT procurement.
But Tampa Republican Representative James Grant says he's not sure the bill will actually accomplish what Engolia says he hopes it will.
I think it's clear that there is a big difference between what this our chairman has said he intends to accomplish and what he wants to do, and what the black and white letters on the bill actually do.
Grant says the measure, as written, walks back many of the advancements lawmakers have worked toward over the years.
Going back to the wild, wild west of every agency being able to pick and choose and determine how they want to buy and how they want to establish their own standards and terminologies. And
Kyle Baltic with Florida Tax Watch says instead of scrapping the current agency, all that may really be needed is a little tune-up.
When you're trying to fix something, if you're replacing an engine, that's a lot more expensive than just changing the oil. Years ago, we had real issues with our Information Technology Center, and as previous testimony has stated, we increased from, I think, a D or D-plus to a B-plus. It's the same idea. We're finally hitting those economies of scale. We're finally reaching efficiencies that we need. And now it's time to put oil in the engine and make sure that the engine doesn't blow out and we have to replace it again.
Engolia agreed to work with Grant and others to clear up concerns, but he says the changes in the bill are needed to ensure agility in the agency as technology advancements come more and more quickly. The measure passed out of the House committee Tuesday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank Joseph Zabias Roig, and assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and please join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2017 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.